Okay, first I guess I should explain a little bit about what the title means. Everyone knows what Einstein's equations are, and I use that term in the conventional sense. I'll be talking only about the vacuum Einstein equations. But Einstein's spaces I'll use in the sense that may not be so familiar, a standard term for mathematicians. Yeah, but with a Riemannian G, there's a whole, there are books on this subject, like the famous one by Arthur Bessa, who I'd be surprised if any of you knew Arthur Bessa, because he doesn't exist, but the book exists, and talks about the subject of Einstein spaces. Arthur thanks his friends in the introduction, and those are the actual authors of the book. People like Bourguignon and LaFontaine, Jerry Kasdan. So, correcting for the typo in the published version of the talk, this is the actual title. This has grown out of joint work with Lars Anderson, Arthur Fischer, and Yvonne Choquet. It's not actually joint work with all those people, but it came out of projects with all those people. And so I'm going to be interested in talking about Einstein spaces. And so let me define that term here in the sense I'll use it. I'm going to be talking about compact manifolds and dimension bigger than or equal to 2. Although for the most part, bigger than or equal to 3, and connected and orientable and so forth. But I want to be talking about Riemannian metrics here. I mean, we'll get to Lorentzian metrics when I start talking about Einstein's equations, but for the purpose of defining what I mean by Einstein spaces, I want a metric to be Riemannian on this compact manifold M. And I'll just say, just following the standard definition, that M gamma is a negative Einstein, I want the negative case for special reasons, is a negative Einstein manifold if, as Jimmy said, Ricci tensor is equal to a constant times the metric, and in this case I want the constant to be negative for reasons that I'll make clear as we go along. So those are the negative Einstein spaces that I want to look at. And why am I interested in those? Well, for any one of those guys, you can write down a, let's say, trivial or obvious solution of Einstein's vacuum field equations. And this time I'm really talking about a Lorentzian metric, and there's no cosmological constant in the vacuum field equation, the standard vacuum field equations. This is peculiar to the Riemannian metric, but then when you write down the Lorentzian metric, here I've called it eta, I forgot to mention that I need gamma normalized so that the scalar curvature is -1, otherwise these formulas would have to be corrected. But the Lorentzian metric is this simple guy here, where you just have the explicit time dependence sitting in front of this fixed time-independent Riemannian metric, and everyone probably recognizes special cases of this. This is nothing other, if you take 3 dimensions, let's say, than the k equals -1 Robertson-Walker vacuum line element. That's the only Robertson-Walker space that you can have that's vacuum. That is the k equal -1 case, and this is nothing other than that guy generalized to n dimensions. So it's very familiar that you can write down this trivial solution. But in fact, if you go to higher than 3 dimensions, the fact that you have an Einstein metric here does not imply that you have a constant negative curvature metric. And so there are many more possibilities that can arise in higher dimensions. And that's what makes these slightly, at least of mathematical interest, if not the physical interest may be a little doubtful for ordinary relativity, but in any case, for mathematical purposes, this is the sort of reason for that book by Bessa, that they were trying to study the existence of these guys in in higher dimensions, and for the negative case, you can always write down this corresponding solution of the true vacuum space-time field equations. And what I want to talk about is perturbations of these guys subject to the actual vacuum field equations in the direction of cosmological expansion. So we'll start looking at fully nonlinear perturbations in principle. As you go towards t equals plus infinity, the idea being that with certain caveats that I'll make later, these backgrounds are attractors for the Einstein equations. And if you think of this as a dynamical system, as I'll explain more fully later, you can look at it as a dynamical system on a space of metrics, or really space of the phase space, for which the configuration space is metrics. And these Einstein metrics are going to be the attractor points of that dynamical system. So that's the sort of meaning of the title.
Are they going to be the only attractors? Or?
They are the only fixed points. I mean, there conceivably could be non-fixed point attractor sets that is not going to be discussed here. I mean, you can have orbits that are attractors that are not fixed points. These are going to be the only fixed points, and they are attractors. That's all I'll be able to.
I'm going to ask, what's a fixed point?
Well, it'll become clear later, but just a stationary point of the dynamical system. I have to tell you what the dynamical system is that factors out this overall time. I mean, this guy is independent of time. And I want to formulate the Einstein equations as a dynamical system in such a way that the rescaled metrics, as I'll define later, reduce to, you know, what include these guys here. And those are the only fixed points.
Does the dynamical system assume this product structure for the four-dimensional space?
Product structure?
Between the real line and...
It assumes that the manifold is... this cross R, yeah,
okay.
But
otherwise it's got a general four-dimensional metric.
General four-dimensional metric, that's right.
This is an attractor for sufficiently small...
It'll be sufficiently small. Well, these will be shown to be the only fixed points with no smallness assumption, but to study the attractor feature of them, you'll be looking at small perturbations of the fixed points, not arbitrarily large perturbations.
Can you make statements about the whole space of solutions in Einstein's equation?
That these are the only fixed points of that whole space. That's going to be, this is in the spatially compact setting here.
Okay.
These are going to turn out to be also characterizable in another way. I'll come back to this point, but as space-times which have a homothetic time-like killing field, it's easy to check that this guy has a homothetic time-like killing field. It's just something like T d by dt or whatever. But in fact, yeah.
One more question. So, I mean, naively, I would expect that perturbations die out just because the universe is expanding.
That's going to be the secret to it, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, are there examples where you don't have an Einstein space, but you still have an expanding universe in which perturbations don't
well, matter? For example, if you form black holes for sufficiently large perturbations here, those would be kind of locked in as kind of defects in the geometry, which are presumably not going to go away. I don't study those by restricting myself to small perturbations of these guys, small but nonlinear.
Is the key that the universe is expanding here, or that you really are having an Einstein space for each t constant t? So you think both are equally important?
I certainly both play a role. Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to balance them, but
in an expanding universe, you should be able to take weak gravitational waves. You could set them up to focus and form a black hole, and you'd have something that would be very different.
But presumably, they won't be weak in his sense. He'll give Sobolev something
sure.
Or other that makes sure he's not really weak.
Energy condition to start with, you can manage. Yeah.
If you are restricting, when you say the only fixed points, et cetera, you're restricting to this negative Yamabe class.
Well, I'll have to say that, but you can say something about the other manifolds that don't admit that they don't have any fixed points at all of this dynamical system. Yeah, you can show that the only possible, I have to tell you what the system is, and then I'll even actually go through the the calculation shows that these are the only fixed points. It's only a few lines, so let me come back to that point when we get to it.
I remember in the 60s or something, people showed these cosmologies went to something called the Lukacs plane wave. Does that mean anything to you?
The Lukacs plane wave? Well, there was a paper by Penrose that says every space time has a plane wave limit.
I think if you don't, I actually don't know what the Lukacs plane wave is. If you don't know what it is, I think there's no point in asking the question. But there were some sort of studies.
Well, I'd be interested to actually see what that means, but I don't know what it means, so I probably shouldn't speculate. So just to say maybe what I've already said in words here, I'm going to be imposing the true vacuum Einstein equations on the Lorentz metric, eta. And here's just a remark that I didn't make before. If it turns out, and these are special cases in higher dimensions, that gamma's so-called hyperbolic metric, that is, has constant negative curvature, then this background guy that we were looking at on the last transparency is a flat metric. I mean, you can regard that space-time as a quotient of Minkowski space in the appropriate dimension. But generally, if gamma is only in higher dimensions, but it has to be true in two and three dimensions because hyperbolic, hyperbolic, well,
constant Ricci
implies hyperbolic in two and three dimensions, but it's not true in higher dimensions, so I'm stating it badly. But, and I've already mentioned that these backgrounds are k equals minus 1. Okay, but needn't be flat in higher dimensions. I want to use as a fixed gauge, and as you probably all quickly recognize, this talk has little to do with numerical relativity, but on the other hand, certain aspects of the background for this talk, namely development of the gauge conditions and we didn't develop the gauge conditions, but Lars and I did a local existence theorem for this gauge in arbitrary dimensions, and that has some potential implications that for numerical calculations that I'll perhaps mention later on. But in any case, the strict gauge that I'm going to use is constant mean curvature slicing. This just tells you what the mean curvature is for the background solutions, and for the backgrounds, it's easy to check that mean curvature ranges over this value at the Big Bang with my sign conventions, which are MTWs, and it goes to zero in the limit of infinite expansion. The proper time here, T, of course, ranges from zero at the Big Bang to infinity at the other end. I can rewrite that same metric in terms of mean curvature time, and it there appears at the bottom. So I want to combine constant mean curvature slicing with something Lars and I found very useful in our local existence results that were laying the groundwork for some of this, namely something called spatial harmonic coordinate conditions. I think most everyone here knows what that means now. It's the purely spatial analog of what Yvonne used in her pioneering results on existence for the Einstein equations using space-time harmonic coordinate conditions. This is just spatial harmonic coordinate conditions, but it has the effect of making the Ricci tensor, the spatial Ricci tensor in the Einstein evolution equations, an elliptic operator, and thereby making the evolution equations for the metric just nonlinear wave equations. Of course, they're also non-local wave equations in the sense that the lapse and shift with these gauge conditions are solutions of elliptic equations that get plugged back in. So it doesn't fall into the category that most people here like to use of, say, symmetric hyperbolic systems. It's rather more what mathematicians call an elliptic hyperbolic system, or I like to think of it more as a non-local hyperbolic system, but however you like to call it. In any case, these harmonic spatial harmonic coordinate conditions actually played a crucial role, and this is something I wanted to mention because it may be useful for numerical things. Lars and I couldn't figure out how to do the energy estimates for local existence until we imposed these particular coordinate conditions. I don't mean they're unique or anything, but we couldn't just take any old coordinate conditions and make the thing work. And the reason it didn't work first of all, we didn't even know if we could make this work until we realized something very special. and that was the following fact. When you work out the shift vector elliptic equation that's forced upon you in imposing these spatial harmonic, it looks like just an everyday elliptic shift vector equation, but it has a very special property that there are no second derivatives of the metric appearing in the elliptic operator. It looks like there would be, because when you have a vector Laplacian, you have derivatives of the Christoffel symbols, and you also have a curvature term that results from commuting derivatives and so forth. So it looks like there's all kinds of second derivatives of the metric. And if there were second derivatives of the metric, we couldn't do the energy estimates because we'd lose a derivative in the shift. It would be less smooth than we wanted it to be, and everything would fall apart. So there was something extremely special about this particular shift vector equation. I pointed that out to Bernd Brueggemann at the time when we were working on this back in Gulm a few years ago. And he has since found some applications for that in numerical calculations. So I think that's something to be aware of. In any case, getting back to the main theme of this, I want to, when you go to these gauge, when you impose these gauge conditions, everything becomes non-autonomous in the sense that the mean curvature, which is playing the role of time, appears in everything. It appears in the evolution equations explicitly, appears in the constraint equations, appears in the gauge equation. Everything is non-autonomous now, but that's easy to fix. I'm just going to define some new rescaled variables in a way I'll define on the next transparency probably, and get back to autonomous form. It's very easy to make this non-autonomous character kind of disappear again. And then I'll go through this fixed point analysis and then talk about how to use higher order energies to prove the fixed points are actually stable. So that's the program. And I here say another characterization of the fixed points. This goes back to something Doug Eardley and Jerry Marsden and Jim Eisenberg and I looked at a long time ago, characterizing homothetic Killing fields in various solutions of Einstein's equations. I won't go into too much detail about that here, except that I've already mentioned that these backgrounds have a homothetic time-like Killing field that in the one coordinate system looks like that. And you can show that with the spatially compact setup that we're in, those are the only solutions which have such a time-like homothety. And so that's another characterization of what these, sometimes those are called continuously self-similar backgrounds. And so, homothetic, constant times the metric, yeah. Proper conformal would be some non-constant function there. So let me define the usual ADM variables. The only difference from this and formula straight out of MTW is the simple modification when you're in n plus one dimensions. By the way, 2 plus 1 is a very special case, of course, and you can go a lot further because that's basically a finite dimensional problem. But even that's got some subtleties. I won't talk much about that, though, because it requires special methods to go a lot further and take us way off on a tangent. So what's this? These are just the usual equations, the evolution equations, and the elliptic equation for the lapse, and I've already mentioned but didn't write it down, the elliptic equation for the shift. Everything's non-autonomous in this form, but if you just look at the physical dimensions of things, I like to take the spatial coordinates to be dimensionless, and then the components of G have dimensions length squared and so on. If you just define a new set of rescale variables using the mean curvature to rescale, this is a fairly obvious trick, but it works rather nicely in this case. Just use the mean curvature tau, which has dimensions 1 over length, to rescale everything and make dimensionless quantities. So G twiddle is the dimensionless analog of the metric and the lapse function and so on in arbitrary dimensions. If you plug that into all the Einstein equations in ADM form, you almost get rid of all the explicit time dependence. The only thing you don't do is get rid of the time dependence that occurs multiplying time. In other words, a time derivative will actually appear in the dimensionless form tau d by d tau. So now all I have to do to get rid of that explicit tau is define a new time variable capital T, and that simple trick makes all the non-autonomous behavior disappear. And furthermore, this T has a nice feature that its natural range, at least its range on the backgrounds, is sort of the new, if you like, the Newtonian range, minus infinity to infinity. So I'm gradually making the system look more like a conventional autonomous dynamical system in a kind of Newtonian time variable. That is, one whose, in quotes, natural range is a whole real line, at least it is for the background solutions, and for which the equations of motion don't have explicit time dependence.
Is this can follow Killing Becker's timeline?
Sorry?
Is this can follow Killing Becker's timeline?
It is everywhere on the background solutions, and yes, yeah. Yeah.
Are you going to show us before it's over the elliptic operator?
It seems I didn't write that down, but the way you derive it is just to...
I had to derive it. I just wondered what the elliptic dimension was.
Well, I've got it written down in notes and can happy to show it to you. Actually, it's not transparent in glancing at it. Lars and I thought we were really sunk until we wrote it out just literally piece by piece and checked that it has the needed behavior.
That it's elliptic?
Well, not as elliptic. It's elliptic pretty obviously, but the fact that it's doesn't have second derivatives of the metric when it looks like it obviously does was the crucial feature.
Some cancellations occur.
Yeah.
But it's covariant spatially.
Yeah, it looks just like anybody's favorite vector elliptic operator, except it's not. It's a little different from the obvious. And you get it, of course, I mean, maybe not everyone knows what I mean by the spatial harmonic gauge condition, but what that looks like in sort of explicit form is you pick a fixed metric. For example, I would choose this background constant Ricci curvature the Einstein metric as my background just for convenience, and then take the moving metric and impose this gauge condition on it, and that's what we, and of course the time derivative of this is what generates the elliptic operator equation. Okay. So now we've got a autonomous dynamic. Of course, Einstein equations were autonomous the way Einstein wrote them down, but now they're gauge fixed and autonomous, and so have a sort of standard form of a, if you like, infinite dimensional mechanical system. So let's look for fixed points, and now what I mean by that is I want to look for solutions for which the rescaled dynamical variables are constant in time. And it's easy to prove by the following few steps that the only such things are what we already guessed. So here's how you do this. It's just about one transparency long in an argument. First, you just contract the G dot equation with pi twiddle, the G twiddle equation dot with pi twiddle, and integrate over the spatial manifold. Remember, I'm dealing with a compact manifold here, and you get that. But you get a similar looking equation if you take the G twiddle trace of the same equation, multiply by tau, which is mean curvature, and integrate. These are not the same, they look almost the same. But if you subtract them, you quickly get something involving the square of the traceless part. This is kind of shorthand notation. That's the traceless part of pi twiddle tensor product with itself, and then take the trace of that. It's multiplied by the lapse, but everyone knows the maximum principal argument that the lapse function on a CMC slicing is greater than zero on the manifold, so it's easy to show that the traceless part of pi twiddle has to be zero. And if you plug that back into the lapse equation, the lapse has to be a constant now. And if you plug that back into everything else, well, for example, the G twiddle dot equation and the pi twiddle dot equation reduced to the shift having to be a killing field of G twiddle and the Ricci tensor of G twiddle having to be, sure enough, a constant multiple of G twiddle, which is where the Einstein metric aspect of this comes out. So it's really that simple to prove that these are the only, well, I haven't quite finished, but this the fixed points are very restricted already in that the spatial rescale spatial metric has to be an Einstein metric, and traceless part of pi twiddle has to be zero. And you can get rid of that shift by a further simple argument. No, I'm not assuming any homothetic killing field. I'm just saying, look at the Einstein equations as a dynamical system formulated in this way for these rescale variables on a compact manifold in arbitrary dimensions. What are the fixed points of that system? They're the guys I wrote down on the first transparency. They're the spacetimes, which do have a homothetic killing field. I didn't assume a homothetic killing field. I get without it at the end of the day.
So to get the Einstein equations in this autonomous form, we're basically null assumptions.
Well, yes and no.
You've got to have a compact manifold across a real line policy, right?
But also, I mean, if you assume this kind of foliation, aren't you building in from the beginning that this is an initially expanding universe that continues expanding everywhere and never contracts even locally?
Well, I should say that, I mean, this argument is vacuous on lots of manifolds in the sense they don't admit Einstein metrics of negative type, and it had to be a negative one if you look carefully at the fine print. But maybe a way of staying it, as David is saying, I could have started out with the topological assumptions that, the main thing to worry about is avoiding maximal slices, so I don't run into trouble rescaling all these variables. Now, maybe this is what you're getting at. I mean, many manifolds are such that just on topological grounds, it's impossible to have a solution of the constraints with a maximal slice. And maybe a better way of starting out would have been to say, let me work on those manifolds, and then this rescaling is always well defined. I'm not sure if I'm making all this completely clear.
What's the status of the existence of the constant mean curvature slicing zone?
I don't know anything more recent than that. If you look at arbitrary vacuum spacetimes on three-manifold or n-manifold cross R and ask, when do you know there's a constant mean curvature slicing, I don't have any further insight on that. There are conditions that people have developed involving barriers and so forth, but they're just replacing one set of assumptions by another. So Lars Anderson, who will be here, I think, next week, is probably.
There's this old idea that claimed some while ago that there were vacuum solutions which had no CMC slices at all.
They didn't publish the proof.
Pardon me?
The proof was never published.
No, as far as I know, that's really not known.
I heard it in 1989.
Yeah.
From Doug, step by step outline, but I never saw the details.
So that's the major assumption here.
There exists a CMC
slice.
That's a good point. There exists a CMC slice and.
One slice or a whole slicing?
Well, there will automatically be a local foliation. We're going to prove there's a global foliation for small enough perturbations of these backgrounds. So maybe a better way of saying this is what my topological restriction is, since I'm only considering perturbations of those guys that admitted Einstein metrics, negative Einstein metrics, is I'm just looking at those N manifolds which admit negative Einstein metrics and perturbations of those. But this previous argument I gave, you could just write down on a general metric, not knowing the topology, and conclude that at the end of the day, if it weren't to admit an Einstein metric, there were no solutions. Maybe I'm saying some here in words. I mentioned the old work with Doug and Jim and Jerry Marsden here about homothetic killing fields that we found that, and this works in n+1 dimensions, though we only considered 3+1, that if you insist that you have a homothetic killing field, you can go through almost a parallel argument to the one I went through and conclude that they have to look like those background space times that we're talking about. So that means that another characterization of these background guys, or they're the ones that have the homothetic symmetry.
So all you really need is one trace case-wise for your, most of your argument.
That's right, local. And then, of course, the background, you know, you just look at the whole space-time, you've got a global foliation, and it will come out of the argument that even the small perturbations have global foliations to the future of, and of course, it requires a detailed argument.
But, I mean, I'm kind of getting at this thing of Charlie's. Is that an assumption or actually a clause?
What exactly?
Trace K constant.
I'm certainly assuming it. Think of it this way, I'm not assuming it I'm starting with specific background solutions to perturb. I mean, one way of stating this problem is, and those have them. Small enough perturbations will have them also. But I threw out a lot of other possibilities that perhaps Charlie was asking about by restricting in that way topologically or...
Right, but I mean, given your topologies, then you get them.
You've got them sitting there in front of you because you're perturbing these specific backgrounds, but I mean...
Given the topologies, there's no further assumption.
Yeah, but we could ask more general questions, I mean, which I'm not doing. Okay, let's see. I mean, the first thing people do in studying a fixed point of a dynamical system, of course, we've got the fixed points, but what do linearized perturbations do when linearized about the fixed point? It turns out this is something Arthur and I worked out, Arthur Fisher, not Arthur Bessa, who doesn't exist, but linearization about a fixed point turns out to be surprisingly easy in this case because of this sort of magic fact. Namely, if you call the perturbations in G and pi, these are not the rescaled quantities, but you can redo everything in terms of those. H and P respectively, and decompose, look at the linearized constraints and linearized gauge conditions. It's natural to look at the TT projections, I mean, to require these to be transverse traceless. Normally, that doesn't work very well in the sense that you need a complicated choice of lapse and shift, or the linearized lapse and shift, to preserve that condition. But it's a magic fact of the fact that the background spatial metric of Einstein, that a trivial choice, namely delta n and delta x equals zero, preserves the TT character of the linear perturbation. So it's pretty easy to kind of write down the linear perturbation equations and analyze them on any of these backgrounds in higher dimensions and not necessarily with a hyperbolic gamma, you know, and so forth. So here I've just written down the standard decomposition of the Riemann tensor of this Einstein metric in terms of its Weyl tensor, and there are no Ricci terms because, of course, I can set them all equal to scalar curvature terms, and so I've sort of collapsed the formula there. But just to remind you that how the conformal tensor fits into the picture, here's what the linearized equations look like, and they're just some. This is the sort of non-autonomous form because I'm not writing things here in terms of the rescale variables. I just got in the habit of sometimes doing it this way and sometimes another way. But this has got explicit tau dependence, but that's a trivial thing to get rid of. In any case, it's a fairly simple-looking wave equation for the transverse traceless perturbations. And you can separate variables by just expanding the tensor perturbations in terms of eigentensors of this operator, which is, I haven't checked it explicitly, but I'm sure this has got to be essentially the elliptic version of the Lichnerowitz operator. So this is the Lichnerowitz Laplacian here, and I'm looking at eigentensors of that guy. And, well, you separate out the variables, you can solve the equations in terms of these eigentensors with eigenvalue lambda, let's say. And I don't know if I want to go through all the details here, just to sort of show you that you can do it and what some of the behavior looks like. So this is for n space dimensions, and one key point here is worth mentioning. If lambda is sufficiently large, which of course for the higher eigenvalues it will eventually get large, then this square root is real, and I've got an imaginary factor here, so that the solution, which looks like this, has a a universal decaying factor that just depends on dimensions. It'll go like tau to the n minus 5 over 2, and then multiplied by an oscillatory factor. But in fact, in certain cases, even the lowest eigenvalue has that property of making this quantity real and therefore giving you this universal rate of decay. The details of this are kind of complicated, and I don't know if I can they're simple to work out, but I mean they're kind of complicated to say in words. But I mean, if you ask yourself, what does it mean for the background to be stable? What you're looking for is that the rescaled perturbation, and that's this guy here, this is the kind of H twiddle TT, if you like, that guy decay asymptotically. And it turns out the condition you need for that is that the minimum eigenvalue, that Lichnerowitz-Laplacian, satisfy this inequality. And well, who would know anything about that? I mean, because who knows what the, well, believe it or not, Arthur Bessa does, because he studied that problem. And for strange reasons, because there's nothing in Arthur Bessa's book about the Einstein evolution equation, but the mathematicians have their own reason for being interested in these Einstein spaces, of course. And they had a criterion which they also call stability, although it's got nothing to do with evolution equations in higher dimensions, of an Einstein metric. And in the negative case, they were led to a stability definition which exactly corresponds to this. And they point out, or it's not, well, they don't say it in so many words, but I've asked a number of geometers, and in the Bessa book it's discussed. There's no known counterexample to stability, in a sense, no one knows a negative Einstein space in higher dimensions for which the lowest eigenvalue, the Lichnerowitz-Laplacian, violates that inequality. You can achieve it equality in a borderline situation, and that happens when there are entire manifolds of Einstein metrics that sort of connected manifolds that fit together. So there's kind of neutral modes where you perturb one Einstein metric to a nearby one. And that's the borderline case. Those families of those guys are known to exist, but the guys where the inequality goes the other way are not. None is yet known. It's an open question of whether they exist. They'd have kind of bizarre properties if they did, because there'd be spaces of perturbations, which finite dimensional subspaces of perturbations, which are stable going back towards the Big Bang, and unstable going toward the future, exactly the opposite of what you expect. So it's not known. Unfortunately, I don't know of any relativity argument that can lead to a mathematical insight into that, but maybe there is one that, you know, sort of the bizarreness of the relativity behavior might suggest a mathematical argument at some point, but I don't know how to do that. You can derive using a integration by parts in identity I first learned from Bobby Baig, that a sufficient condition for stability is this thing given here. It's a condition on the Weyl tensor of the background. It's automatically satisfied for a hyperbolic metric where Weyl is zero. Then this inequality is trivially satisfied, except in two dimensions, which is special because of the existence of so-called Teichmuller space. But that's way off on another tangent. So, in any case, here's the reference to the section in Bessa. And well, if that constant in the solution was greater than zero, you get these decaying solutions, as I said before. Well, so much for the linearized problem. So what I'm saying is that, as far as anyone knows, the known solutions, and that includes all the hyperbolic ones, which are of which there are infinitely many in all dimensions, are stable in this sense that we're talking about. And there are no known examples for which they would be unstable. But that's at linearized level. What can you say about the fully nonlinear problem, which is what I want to deal with? Well, I'm only going to be able to treat, as already mentioned, small perturbations of these backgrounds. Otherwise, you know, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, you can certainly get black holes and so forth. If you do large perturbations in a higher dimension, you can probably get all kinds of bizarre behavior that people haven't even dreamed of yet. Higher dimensional analogs of black holes and black strings and all kinds of things. So I'll leave that to Gary to tell us about. But I mean, in any case, you know, one of the claims coming out of this will be that for small enough perturbations, none of this interesting stuff happens, and you just get basically what you expect from the linearized analysis. But how would you jack up the linearized analysis to something about the nonlinear problem? Here's a little model problem that seems too Mickey Mouse at the outset, but it'll turn out to be a nice model for what you do later on in the Einstein case. Let me just take the damped harmonic oscillator. That equation of motion for the linear perturbation after separation of variables was nothing other than a damped harmonic oscillator. So in particular, one case, the case where I had a universal rate of decay corresponds to just this inequality. This is the so-called underdamped case, and everyone knows how to solve the damped harmonic oscillator equation. It has this universal rate of decay and then an oscillatory factor. But what if you tried to prove this? What if you tried to prove that the solution decays by some more robust method instead of just trying to solve it explicitly, which you're not going to be able to do in a nonlinear problem? Well, you try some energy approach. And so you write down an energy like this. Here's the most obvious energy for an oscillator. But of course, that doesn't work, because if you take the time derivative of the energy, decay's all right, but you can't extract a rate of decay out of this, because you only get part of the energy on the right-hand side. You don't get the whole energy. In other words, I can't get this exponential decay factor out of it. If I had the whole energy, I'd be in business, but I don't. But you can fix that, and I think this technique goes back to Lyapunov, or Alan Rendell told me that this was an old trick. And it works this way in a simple problem. You can modify this naive energy with a term that's indefinite. It's in x and it times x dot there. And I've chosen the appropriate coefficient for this particular underdamped case. First of all, adding this indefinite term with that coefficient still leads to a definite quantity here. This bounds both x and x dot. So this is as good an energy, if you like, as this guy. But now its time derivative is just what you want. It gives a multiple of the whole thing, and therefore you get exponential decay, which is what you knew had to be true. But I mean, you have to prove it by some more robust method, and now you know how to do that. Well, this also works in the overdamped case. It's a little more intricate here. Let me not go through the details, but you have to adjust the coefficient of this gamma term and recheck that it still gives a definite quantity, and then you get an inequality here, but everything still works. What we want to deal with a nonlinear problem, so what if I just put in a more or less arbitrary autonomous forcing term there, and the only thing I'll insist about it is that it be autonomous, and that all the linear pieces have been pulled over and put on this side. So I've already included any terms linear in x and x dot in the left-hand side. So this is in some sense literally nonlinear, or strictly nonlinear. Then what you would get is an equation of motion for this guy. And I'm basically going to copy this technique exactly later on the Einstein case. So this is really something that's useful to go through. Do the obvious calculation of the time derivative, and you get what you had in the linear case plus a junk term that has no good properties. It doesn't have a good sign, and you don't know what to do about it. But since it is strictly nonlinear, you can bound it in terms of this piece of the energy to some power. So in other words, this expression is boundable by some constant times the corrected energy to some power bigger than one.
What happened with the J term?
It got bounded by this thing. This is an inequality now.
Okay,
so now you have an energy inequality, which you can rewrite this way. And here's the good term that was there from the linear problem. Here's the bad term. Well, at least you have to assume it's bad because you don't know anything better about it. But it's boundable in terms of a power bigger than zero of the energy. And the point is, if the energy is sufficiently small initially, this term wins and the thing starts to decay. But if it starts to decay, this just gets smaller still, and it just decays more and more until it's asymptotically decaying at the rate of the linear problem, and that's what you sort of expect. So this is a more or less robust way of trying to use energy methods to handle these. There's nothing new about this as far as I know. It probably goes back to Lyapunov. But now let's try it for the Einstein problem here. And there's a lot of complicated formulas here, but I just wanted to put them down to show you that I actually have gone through most of this analysis. It's not completely finished yet, but Lars and I and Yvonne and I on related projects have gone through all the details already. For example, in 3 plus 1, Lars and I have a finished paper on basically this kind of analysis. So we know it all works in that case, and that's why I don't feel too guilty about talking about it here, even though I haven't finished all the details in this case. But let me just show you as far as it goes what you actually can, what you actually do. So I want to decompose the ADM evolution equations for the rescale variables into kind of at least almost linear terms and then junk terms, which I have to add in back later. And I say almost linear because, well, the gamma dot equation, remember the what I do here is I replace the lapse function by the background value of the lapse, which was just a constant, namely the dimension, and then the remainder part of the lapse will be appearing in the junk terms, which I haven't written over here. So I decompose the lapse into its background plus a perturbation and put that perturbation over in the junk, which is not written here. And I do same thing for the second fundamental form, the rescaled second fundamental form, except I can't really put all the nonlinear terms into the junk, because here this basically comes from the Ricci curvature expanded out. It looks like an elliptic operator on the metric perturbation, but I have to put the full actual metric in there. I can't put the background gamma twiddle metric in there. I could, but then the difference would appear in the junk terms, and it would involve these higher derivatives in the junk terms, and they'd never be boundable in terms of the energy that I'm going to define. So you could never get away with that, and that makes sense physically. I think you have to capture the right light cones, so to speak. But that's I think the only term where I don't really literally have linear terms here. So I've decomposed the ADM evolution equations into these almost linear pieces plus junk terms, which are written out explicitly. Here I've introduced some shorthand notation where this operator is L is defined down here, and C is the Weyl tensor, the background metric. I mean, you had to decompose the, I mean, there's lots of junk terms. I mean, you had to decompose the full right-hand side of the ADM evolution equations and put them down there, but they're on a separate sheet of paper somehow. So how do I, and here's a summary once again of the harmonic gauge condition that I'm talking about. You can write it in a shorthand way. So what about energies? How am I going to define energies that will do the job analogous to those simple energies for the damped harmonic oscillator? Well, the first thing I propose here is a kind of an obvious sort of zeroth order energy. It's like L2 in the rescaled second fundamental form, or the traceless part of the second fundamental form. This is the background metric, by the way, so and these, but the twiddle here refers to the perturbation, I mean the actual second fundamental form. And then if you integrated by parts, you could get one of the derivatives in this L operator acting on the perturbed metric. So this is morally, at least, looks like a L2 cross H1 norm of the perturbations. But I need that Lyapunov correction factor to make it work. And here I take the kind of most obvious thing. Remember, in the damped harmonic oscillator, it was like an XX dot term. Well, here's the X and here's the X dot, if you like, so it's the same structure. But this is never going to work by itself because you can't even prove local existence in n plus 1 dimensions until you go to a relatively high Sobolev order, as Lars and I worked out. It's the classical one. It's S is greater than n over 2 plus 1 is in our theorem, and we didn't try to improve on that, and other people know how to do it, but we didn't try to, but you have to go to higher spatial derivatives in order to bound that norm. So you define a whole sequence of energies, and you define them differently according to whether you're in the analog of the underdamped, critically damped, or overdamped cases. Now, what decides that? Well, the lowest eigenvalue of the Lichnerowitz operator on the background is what decides that. That's the kind of analog of the low frequency, if you like, in the harmonic oscillator. So you have to treat different cases according to what that lowest eigenvalue is, sort of greater than, equal to, or less than a certain critical value, which I won't go into. But here, just to show you that you can explicitly write these formulas down, here's the sort of even order energy that I write down, where K is just some integer that represents essentially the half the number of spatial derivatives you're going to let act on K. Here, LK has got two, I mean, this is the kth power of that operator acting. And similarly here, if I integrated by parts once, pull off half one of those L's, I could symmetrize this and make it look more symmetric. And here is the correction term that's going to be essential to make that work. This is this Lyapunov type indefinite term. So what do I claim about all these? Well, one thing that's fairly easy to check. By the way, these are, by definition, the exact formulas of the energy. What you've got to do, though, is calculate their time derivatives using the full, not linearized, evolution equation. You've got to include all the junk terms. But what's easy to do is just to check that if you throw away the junk terms, you get exactly what you want. You get the time derivatives of the corrected energies proportional to the corrected energies. And of course, when you add in all the junk terms, you'll get plus all the junk. But the point is, if you go to high enough Sobolev order, you're going to be able to bound that junk in terms of some power of this corrected energy, just exactly in parallel to the model problem.
What differs depending on, so you said there's a critical value of the first eigenvalue of the Schnow operator, right? And that you said that divides a critical damping from a...
Well, we could look back on an earlier transparency and see.
Does it qualitatively change the argument or the behavior of the solutions?
Well, yes, in the sense it does. Just in the way a damped harmonic oscillator has universal rate of decay that just depends on alpha if you're underdamped, but it has in the overdamped case, the rate of decay is no longer universal and so forth, and all those can occur. I mean, I don't know if I know examples of all those things, but I believe they can all occur in solutions of Einstein's equations. So asymptotical, this would show up in the asymptotic decay of certain modes. The lowest modes would either have this universal rate of decay, which just depends on the dimension of space, or it would be a slower rate of decay, which would be telling you that the lowest, basically be telling you what the lowest eigenvalue of Lichnerowitz-Laplacian was. Well, I'm just about done here, but one last so, I mean, I really have, calculated out all the junk terms. What I haven't completely done, but I know how to do, is to add those back in and bound them in terms of a power of this total corrected energy. And you can only expect to do that if you work up to the needed Sobolev order. In other words, where you're going to need this K to be large enough is in making that last step work, because you'll have all these junk terms, and you have to use Sobolev inequalities to show that I can bound these guys by some power of the energy carried out to that that order, and that'll work. Well, trust me on it. I mean, but I mean, I have to do it, but. I'm claiming we know how to do that, and that'll work if you go to the right Sobolev order. So that has to be checked. Here's the last thing I mentioned here. For the underdamped case, this is getting back to Jim's question, you have to make a further correction. This first piece just kind of subtracts off the correction you made before, and this modifies and adds back in what you should have put there in the overdamped case. Something that reflects this lowest eigenvalue of the background Lichnerowitz operator, that'll do the job for you, it turns out. And so this would be the modification you make to handle the overdamped case when this lambda minimum is below a certain critical value. And so just at the bottom here, it says what I need to do, but I know how to do. I mean, I haven't done it, but I know how to do it. And that is to show the corrected energy bounds that needed Sobolev norms, and we need this Sobolev spaces with S bigger than dimension over 2 plus 1 for the classical results on local existence. And the junk terms are boundable by a power greater than 1 of the corrected energy. So that's the thing, one of the projects I hope to finish up while I'm here, but or at least this summer sometime. So that's it. Thank you.
I thought you said earlier that if you had an example of a manifold where this lowest eigenvalue was below this Bessé bound, then the perturbation would actually grow in the future and not decay.
That's right. I can't. These methods won't handle that case. In other words, I'm assuming, I forgot to say that, but I'm assuming from a certain point on that at least I have linearized stability.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are the Gaudi spacetimes related to this as a nonlinear perturbation?
The problem with Gaudi is that I don't think they fall into this category. I mean, a lot of the known examples you can think of are not perturbations of these background guys because they don't live on the right manifolds and they don't have, you know, a spatial metric sitting in there which could, in special cases, be.
That would
work with T3, for example. No, T3 is what you need topologically. I mean, well, what you really need, as I should have said at the beginning, what I'm really doing is working on manifolds, compact manifolds, which admit a negative Einstein metric, and that's just some big set of guys, including all the hyperbolics, so it's an infinite set in all dimensions bigger than or equal to 2, so it's clear it's non-empty, but it's a lot bigger than the hyperbolics in higher dimension, or at least somewhat bigger, and those are the guys I'm talking about.
So does that include T3?
No, it doesn't. T3 does not admit a hyperbolic metric.
None of the guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I understood this correctly, if the perturbations are not too big, then of course this fixable.
Yes.
Right? How does the size of the bound depend on the size of the original compact universe?
Well, when you say original, of course, I start at a given value of mean curvature, although in some sense the value you take in terms of these rescale variables is kind of irrelevant. Everything's being done in a kind of scale invariant way. The thing that determines how small the perturbation has to be in a rescaled sense is how small does it have to be to make this energy less than critical value you need for decay. In other words, let me flash back to something here that will clarify that, if I can kind of sort of, I mean, let's just look at this oscillator problem. What does smallness mean for the damped oscillator when there's a forcing term in there that I can bound by this power of the energy? Well, the smallness I need to get decay, even in the presence of this nonlinear forcing, is initially at time T naught, this guy has to be less than 1, and that just puts a bound on the energy that you're allowed to. So any energy smaller than that, you can handle. And any energy larger than that, you can't say anything about.
But if you think of our universe, right, I mean, it looks sort of hyperbolic, but then it might be on a compact manifold, right, it's sufficiently big, right, out beyond where we can see. So how big a perturbation could you tolerate?
Well, curiously, something came up in the Larsen my analysis, it depends on, in physical terms, how big the perturbation be in the sense of how big the curvature can be. It can be arbitrarily big as long as you start sufficiently close to the Big Bang. In other words, if you put curvature as a dimension quantity the way one usually thinks of, I mean, it's just a trick of scaling. I mean, it's not as dramatic as what I may be making it sound, but it's nevertheless literally true that the dimensionful curvature can be arbitrarily large if you're willing to start arbitrarily close to the Big Bang for the trivial reason that even if you start with a small, you can rescale everything And that corresponds to going back further and...
That's with tau getting...
That's with tau getting very, very large.
What tau we see, or something, you know, how old...
Well, you mean today's value of tau? Oh, yeah, then, well, then one would just have to see what, well, now, wait a minute. I mean, these are scale invariant arguments. In principle, I could work out in everyday terms how small or large the perturbation can be today, and I certainly...
Sure, it's asked the question in a simpler way, right? Could this result have anything to do with our universe?
Probably not. I mean, for one thing, we most likely have black holes all over everything. I forgot to say that in the work with Lars, and certainly we know how to repeat that here, the last step in the argument is to show with all the estimates and the decay that you get out of this, you prove causal geodesic completeness to the future. And that's basically saying there aren't any black holes, or one interpretation of that is you aren't allowing black holes to form. And since our universe presumably is full of black holes, that this has nothing to do with our universe.
But if we wait long enough time, it will evaporate by the Hawking process.
Well, this doesn't deal with quantum effects either, so.
Start then.
Oh, we could do that. Oh, that you could do. Then it might be.
But then would it apply?
As far as I know, yeah.
I think the point is that this energy is an integral over all space of your perturbation squared and derivative of the perturbation squared.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what I would guess, that the bound gets more stringent the bigger.
Yeah, space. Right. That's a good question. Let me think about that and try to answer you later. I'm not sure. The confusion is that everything's been rescaled so that it's a scale invariant,
yeah,
and you have to kind of put the scale back in to see what it means.
You lost track of it.
Yeah. But that's very convenient because that makes the whole system autonomous. It means the notion of fixed points is kind of has its everyday sense. They're just literally points sitting there in the phase space. Yeah.
You told me once you were doing some stuff with Bianchi type 3. So if you've been able to get an autonomous version of that as well?
No. There are lots of manifolds where instead of having this relatively benign behavior asymptotically, and I mean going to the future, you have this so-called Cheeger-Gromov collapse phenomenon in the conformal geometry where, for example, in Bianchi 3, a simple compactified version, it looks like a space looks like a higher genus surface across a circle. And what happens asymptotically, I'll probably say this backwards, but if you rescale things, is that the circle collapses and the base manifold stays fixed. So that's an example of so-called Cheeger-Gromov collapse. And Yvonne and I treated nonlinear perturbations of that, but we pulled a trick of assuming killing field in the circle of fiber direction, so we could do Kaluza-Klein reduction and kind of dodge the implications of Cheeger-Gromov collapse, because then you have really nasty problems. You have non-autonomous behavior. You have degenerating Sobolev constants. Everything that could go wrong is going to go wrong in that case. So no one knows how to do that, I think, except at linearized level. And this Tanimoto has worked out the linearized perturbation, which I think lays the groundwork for. I'm not saying this is impossible to handle. In fact, he and I had the idea that there were some energy arguments you could apply. But I mean, even doing the linearized analysis was a couple of years of work on his part to get all the tensor harmonics and equations separated. Those are nasty problems.
Charlie wrote down on that some solution of everything that could go wrong.
I know about that paper, but that was Taub-Nutz based. Luckily, I don't have to face that either, because that's positive Yamabe type and manifold.
Any other questions? Once again.